Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Solidarity Breakfast, and it's a cloudy day out there. I did the weather report.
Hello, Tobias. How are you? Brief one. Good. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Solidarity Breakfast.
Yeah, that's right. Let's hopefully you're as excited about it as we are. We've got some headlines, but we're going to mainly concentrate on something that happened.
Over the last week, yeah. So this is regarding the The mayor of New York City, Zoran Mamdani, as he called out a prominent Palestinian writer and organizer, Susan Abdullahawi, and the first lady of New York, who was under attack from the Zionist lobby. And so Mamdani capitulated. We can listen to that.
Yesterday, I went to an iftar at a friend's home. And I got home a bit late. Little did I know that in the time that I spent enjoying the company of my friends that evening and catching up, a storm was brewing in New York that placed me at the center of what appears to be a coordinated attack on New York City's First Lady Rema Douagi. The story went something like this. Rema illustrated an essay that I wrote, and she must therefore be an anti-Semite merely for this professional, at least 3 degrees removed proximity to me. Mayor Mamdani then held a press conference in which he denounced me using adjectives like reprehensible, and he explained accurately that Rema and I do not know each other, have never met, and have had no direct or indirect interactions. Unfortunately, that was the only accurate part of what was said. So I want to clear a few things up for Mr. Mamdani, for his supporters and detractors alike, for the reporters, for my readers, for my own friends, and for the public in general. So let me start with the essay itself. It is not, in fact, an essay. It is a short story, and I am not the author. The story is entitled A Trail of Soap. It was written by Diana Slayeh, a brilliant young woman in Gaza who survived and continues to try to survive Israel's genocide and unceasing attempts at ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their homeland. Diana is one of a couple dozen young people whom I mentored over the course of 8 writing workshops that I conducted in Gaza in 2004 during 2 trips that I made to Gaza in the middle of Israel's relentless bombing campaigns to obliterate Gaza. It was not an easy feat for these young people to gather for the workshops, but they spent hours walking, cycling, or taking donkey carts to get to our meeting places for the writing workshops. There were times even when their lives were at risk to get to and from the meeting places. And I say this because it matters. Because one wonders why would they risk their lives to get to writing workshops. Israel had reduced their lives to rubble. Israel had reduced their dreams and their ambitions to mere daily quests for sufficient sustenance. Israel had interrupted, maybe even dismantled, their psyches with ineffable trauma. They had stripped them of the most basic human dignities. In fact, the particular short story in question chronicles the details of the first time that Diana had to contend with using a public toilet that was shared by hundreds of women who walked out of their tents and waited in line, waited in filth, in misery, just to use the bathroom in the morning. So these young people risked dangers that most of us cannot begin to fathom, just to attend writing workshops, because it was a singular outlet for intellectual exercise and creative expression. They came so they could be reminded of their potential. They came to feel that they are more than creatures seeking food and water and shelter, that they have a place in the world, that they have a voice, a relevance, something to contribute. They came to touch the lives that they thought they might still have, even if it was just for a few hours. It is important that you know this about the story that Rama Douagi illustrated, because it has been my honor and my privilege to know these young people, to have instigated, compiled, translated, and with my friend Huzama Habayeb, edit this bilingual collection of 18 short stories by 18 beautiful, courageous individuals who deserve to be heard, to be read, to be protected. I hope Rama likewise feels the same honor and privilege to have brushed up against them. Their book is called Every Moment is a Life, Gaza in the Time of Genocide. And let me take a moment to thank the Zionists for this bit of publicity for the book. But moving on, I want to speak about this accusation of anti-Semitism against me, and also about the nature and requisites of racism in general. At the most basic level, I'll start with the word Semite. Unlike the white Ashkenazi Jews attacking me, I am an actual Semitic person. Semitism is just another part of our identity that they have stolen. Zionists have dispossessed us of our homes, our heritage, our land, our ancestral cemeteries, our orchards, our artifacts, our books, archives, photos, resources, and so, so much more. They wear our skin, literally, from their famed skin bank, which they've built from the mutilated bodies of our martyrs. And they wear our skin figuratively in the indigenous stories they have appropriated, the culinary and sartorial heritage that these European Jewish supremacist colonizers claim as their own. So I will address instead anti-Jewishness and the nature of racism in general. Because the most fundamental characteristic of racism, in fact, the primary and maybe only prerequisite for any kind of racism, is a power gradient. It's a power differential that facilitates the transfer of abuse and oppression from those with power against those without power. Thus, racism is unidirectional. It can only flow from those who have power. The mistrust or hatred even that occurs in reverse is something else. It is the most natural reaction to the sustained systemic abuse, oppression, and violence from those who deem themselves superior, better, divinely favored, and so on. For example, the sniper who shot my friend Jihan's 3-year-old daughter, Noor, shattering both her tiny legs while she was in her mother's arms in Gaza, is a hateful, racist ghoul. I understand that's one of the things I've been criticized for saying, and I double up on it, frankly. But the rage, the disgust, even hatred that Jihan or I feel toward that sniper is not racism. It is not anti-Jewishness. It is not anti-Semitism. Nor are her feelings toward the tank operator who blew out the back of her son Arab's head, making her fingers sink into his brains when she tried to pick him up. Our feelings or words in response to 78 years of this barbaric colonial violence are not reprehensible, they are not anti-Semitic, and they are not anti-Jewish. In fact, despite everything they have done to us, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of Jews, both inside and outside of Israel, support this Zionist carnage and domination, we still have the tender human sense to recognize those Jews, however a minority they might be, who do not support Israel, and to embrace the far smaller minority who are anti-Zionist, in fact. People like Ilan Pape, Richard Falk, Mark Perlmutter, Aaron Mate, Katie Halper, Max Blumenthal, Nituri Karta, the Jews who expend their skills and labor to expose Jewish supremacist Zionist criminality. We have kept our humanity despite the unceasing and layered violence against us. The feelings we have of pain, rage, contempt, or hatred, coupled with the impotence to make the suffering stop, is what we call in Arabic qahr. It is a reaction to the kind of violent racism that one does not have the power to meaningfully alter or alleviate. It is important that you understand the difference, Mr. Mamdani. Israel, and by extension Israelis, since, as we're constantly told, they're the only democracy in the region, have destroyed, shattered, and robbed my family of everything. They have done the same to every Palestinian family, no matter where they are on this planet. They have committed a genocide in full view of the world. In the wholeness of its blood and gore, its apocalyptic horror, its generational injury, and its moral harm to all of humanity. No words can adequately capture the evil I have witnessed or experienced at their hands. I do not have sufficient language to describe what they have done to us, what Gaza smells like, feels or looks like up close now. But it is the kind of knowledge that alters one's life and makes you understand that the very least one can do is to speak truth to power, to have the courage of one's convictions, to exercise the privilege of having a voice, however muted or shadow banned it might be, to speak forcefully for those who are defenseless against hateful colonial state violence. That is all the power I have, and I will continue to use it so long as I breathe. I do not have the power to materially change our condition or even to harm our tormentors, but they do have that power, and they use it daily against us all. In my case, it has meant that I and my family, in addition to being dispossessed, exiled from our homeland, have been fired from our jobs, canceled, marginalized, disinvited, and otherwise curtailed our livelihoods. They have used their power to persuade leading politicians to publicly disparage me. You are not the first, Mr. Mamdani. Zionist billionaires, South Australia's premier, one of my own foreign publishers, journalists, UPenn University president, and members of the Board of Trustees, and many other powerful people preceded you in attacking me for daring to not mince words or self-censor when I speak of the demonic forces that have been wreaking havoc on our bodies, our lives, our children, our very place in the world. But you are the one who has compelled me to respond like this. No one has a right to criticize what we say about or how we describe those who've set up sexual torture camps like Sdet Iman, where over 10,000 Palestinians who were kidnapped from their homes in Gaza are being starved, beaten, raped, mutilated, and tortured as I speak. No one can tell me how I should speak about the people who forced my proud grandmother into a bug-infested shack so foreign Jews could live in her Jerusalem home. No one will tell me what to say about the Israelis who set our anguish to music and made TikTok trends from the mangled bodies of our babies. So, Mr. Mamdani, I was disappointed to hear what you said, but the truth is I'm not mad at you, and I strangely am not taking it personally. I did not have the same visceral reaction that others had to condemn you. My overriding impulse was to correct and educate. In that spirit, and in the time-honored tradition of Arab or Muslim aunties offering unsolicited advice, I would like to encourage you to do the following. Number one, when you feel pressure of powerful people asking you to condemn someone or something, just pause and gather information so you can construct a full picture from which you can then make a moral decision, not a politically expedient or convenient decision, but a moral and ethical one. Because ultimately, that is what New Yorkers saw in you when they elected you against all odds to lead them. Number two, in making such a decision, always be aware of the power dynamics and try to never condemn those without power or with lesser power as a reaction to pressure from those with tremendous power, those with access to wealth, media influence, political positions, and so on. I offer these words in the spirit of this holy month coming to a close now, and I offer it from a personal and collective Palestinian wound that opens wider with every new assault, with every moment of violence, denial, marginalization, demonization, denigration, diminishment, humiliation, theft, appropriation, dismemberment, trauma, and dispossession poured on us every day of every year in one way or another. Lastly, and separately, I want to congratulate you on the work you have done and continue to do for the working families in New York. I have watched with admiration how you centered municipal workers as the heroes in every snowstorm, how you reimagined childcare as a right for every working family and as a social responsibility for everyone. These are things worthy of respect and admiration. But in this instance, you have erred. You succumbed to forces that seek to pick away at you, at your talented, beautiful wife, and at your work, clawing harder with each apology or concession you make. If you are not careful, they will siphon your soul before you even realize it. I wish you well, Mr. Mamdani. If you or Rama are readers of novels, especially historic fiction, I would love to send you a stack of my books. Because literature, art, music, these are the most profound landscapes where humans can meet each other across geographic, generational, linguistic, racial, and cultural borders. And let me close this sincere message with the hope of glory to our martyrs and victory to every nation, every individual anywhere today fighting against the tyranny.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast. It was a long piece.
Yeah, it was, but I think it's an important one. It covers pretty much everything and closes off an important commentary that I think we can all take on board.
Yeah, we're going to go now to down to the front of the State Library on Sunday, last Sunday. There were two events, but the first part was about a memorial for the Christchurch massacre, which happened 7 years ago, very tied to the Australian context because, of course, the killer was an Australian white supremacist. And as one of the people in this little piece recognises that in actual fact, Christchurch is the epicentre or was the epicentre of white supremacy in New Zealand. So it was not surprising to many that it should happen there. But this is some of the people speaking at that memorial.
Islamophobia, which was chosen post the Christchurch massacre to be on 15th of March. Next up, we're going to hear from Shakira Hussain, who is a writer and researcher affiliated with the University of Melbourne. She spent a month in Atotahi Christchurch in 2022, funded by a Neilma Sydney Literary Award. Please welcome her.
Mukhtar Ibrahim would have been 10 years old by now. This week he would have been celebrating the holy month of Ramadan with his family. He'd be old enough now to perhaps join them in the fasting. He would definitely be excited at the thought of all the special food that is being served for iftar and looking forward to the new clothes and the presents that he would have been receiving for Eid al-Fitr. High school would have been just a few short years away from him. And after that, who knows? Maybe he would have become a police officer, as his family used to speculate back when he used to run around the house dressed up as a police costume, pretending to be a cop. Or as another member of his Somali community reflected, perhaps he could have grown up to be a great doctor or even prime minister. But Mukhtar Ibrahim was one of the 51 Muslims murdered by an Australian terrorist in Atahu, Christchurch, New Zealand, on 15th March 2019, when he was just 3 years old. He was not just collateral damage. The Australian who murdered Mukhtar and the other Shaheeds spoke of his deliberate choice to target children because they could be the parents of future Muslims. Because murdering children is a way of murdering the future. As Tazim said, it was my immense honor to spend a month in Otahi Christchurch in 2023 and to speak to members of the congregation at the mosque that I first saw through the GoPro lens of the man who went there to commit murder. I'm guessing that's the first time you saw that masjid too. But I was immensely moved by the strength of that community and by the sentiments that I heard there. I did not speak to Farid Ahmed, whose message we just heard, although I saw him. He had been so generous in sharing his message globally that I did not want to place further imposition upon him. But I had expected that his message of forgiveness, which you've just heard reiterated now, I thought that, that would be unusual. Mostly because I couldn't myself imagine summoning that sentiment if one of my loved ones had been killed in such a manner. But although it was not universal, it was a sentiment that I did hear from others. Some who said they had not yet forgiven spoke of how they were working towards that point. But forgiveness, and here I'm not speaking for Farid Ahmed, I'm speaking for conversations generally. Forgiveness did not mean that they did not want accountability. Because of course they did not want to see this tragedy repeated. And it has been. Academics and researchers speak of the so-called Christchurch effect. Because just as the Australian terrorist who murdered in Christchurch was inspired by the far-right terrorist who committed murder in Oslo, others have gone on and stated that they were inspired to follow in the footsteps of the Australian terrorist. On one of my visits to Christchurch coincided with such an attack on an African-American grocery store in the United States. And members of the Christchurch congregation were receiving messages from Charles saying, gloating that the killing had continued. So the way that we speak about and remember Christchurch matters. We must remember Christchurch. It has been too easily forgotten, shrugged off, particularly in the nation whose racism spawned his hate. But we must also not censor the killer, because that is what they want. They want to live on in glorious publicity. So we must talk of them in a way where we talk with those who are killed are as interesting to us as those who do the killing. Where we think as much about a three-year-old boy, we consider him as interesting, as worthy of publicity, as we do the man who killed him. So, I would urge you to become as familiar with the names and stories of the Shaheeds of Christchurch as you are of any terrorist whose name you ever see in the headlines. Do not forget what happened on 15th of March. But remember it in a way that honours those who died, not that give publicity to the man who killed them.
Kahi koi tatai mai te awati te moana. Mo ke tonu, ka papai tonu matau. Ki te ru whaka mo ka tina. Ki a kaha, ki a mai a, ki a manawa nui e tenei wā. Kua e piro, he waka e ke noa. Ki te ru whaka mo ka tina, tina. Kato hira, hira ki tua.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Kei te mihi ki ngā mana whenua o te rohi, ki Wurundjeri Wurrung me Burnerong, kei te mihi. Kei te mihi ki Muslim whānau o te ao, kei te mihi. Kei te mihi ki a Ramadan o tēnei wā, ki whaka āro, whakaroa me aroha ai. Kei te mihi tō nākau, kei te mihi tō hā, kei te mihi tō tangata mate, kei te mihi tō tangata ora, kei te mihi tō mokopuna. Tēnā tātou, tēnā tātou, tēnā tātou katoa. Kia ora e te whānau. My name's Johan, and behind me are the beautiful Waiata Takatāpu I Rōpū. I did grow up on Kaitahu land, which is the tribal lands of where so-called Christchurch now stands. And after March 15th, there was a resounding rhetoric within New Zealand that this is not us. Engari, as someone who grew up in the streets of Christchurch, I saw white supremacy every single day. It was like breathing air there. It is the hub of white supremacy of New Zealand. So along with so-called Australia, the settler colonial state of New Zealand also needs to take accountability every single day, and they are not. So we stand here in solidarity with our Muslim whānau during Ramadan to honour the 51 martyrs and their families whose lives have been forever changed by this horrific event. In Te Reo Māori, the word for love is aroha. Aro meaning to pay attention to, ha meaning our breath. So to love is a practice of making precious the breath of another. And so today we honour everyone's breath here. We honour the breath of Muslims all around the world. And we honour the breaths that were taken on the 15th of March. All right. So we're going to sing you a couple of waiata today. The first one is Puri Anei that was written by Hirini Melbourne. Hirini Melbourne is a beautiful singer from up north, a tohunga of our songs. And Puri Anei is written, to puri is to cleanse oneself, and this is about cleansing the spirit after death. The second song we'll sing is Nā Iwie, which is a song of kotahitanga. Tahi meaning one, kotahitanga meaning to make one, which is about unity. And not unity is in sameness, unity is in all the important different threads that make the tapestry of this world. So thank you so much for having us today, and we mourn and honour and remember alongside you. E mihi ana.
Thank you. Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobias. And as you said, Tobias, this is a chock-a-block program. That's the problem. You go out there and collect information.
Yeah, it's wall-to-wall this week.
Yep, absolutely. And we're going to go now to the follow-up event that happened on Sunday. This was, of course, the anti-war rally. It did get a bit confused with a whole range of other things. I don't know if you were there, Tobias, but...
No, but I heard there was some outside agitators coming in to
and you can hear it. You can hear it in this particular recording. This is David Shoebridge, who came down from New South Wales. He's a Green senator, very staunch fellow. And as I was saying to Tobias, as he was giving his speech, he was sort of beginning to tremble with anger, I think it was. There was also later in the event, as they did a rally, which I didn't catch, but there were a whole lot of people who were representatives of Iranian people who were so very upset that people weren't putting the assault on Iran front and centre. There was more of a message of anti-war, but of course for the Iranians and their families that are there, they're experiencing it right close up. And of course our thoughts go out to them and also to the Lebanese, who are also in the sights of the Israeli attacks. As we've been told, the Israelis don't seem to think that there is any holes bars. They're using white phosphorus in domestic areas. White phosphorus anywhere is a war crime. Coming up now is David Shoebridge.
Example of leadership. Many of you will know him for standing up for justice and liberation for all. David Shoebridge. David Shoebridge is a Green Senator for New South Wales and is the Australian Green spokesperson on justice, digital rights, defence, foreign affairs and immigration. Prior to being elected to the Senate, David was an MP in the New South Wales Parliament and the Chair of the Public Accountability Committee. As the Australian Greens Defence spokesperson, he and his team have been instrumental in exposing the toxic AUKUS deal, as well as Australia's involvement in the supply chain of F-35. Now, can I please remind everybody before David speaks to not engage with Zionists and to keep our focus and messaging clear. And that is free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Our drop here is very clear, and I want everybody to listen to me very carefully. Our drop here is very clear. To sit still and to not engage. The Zionists can sit and chant all they want. They can spew out all the hate that they want. But we are not going to give them any attention. We are not going to give them any attention because the words of peace that support the slaughter of innocent men, women and children do not matter. They do not matter at all. So we do not engage and we continue to chant, free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
From the river to the sea!
Palestine will be free!
Now please join me in welcoming David. Free, free Palestine!
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 Ah, free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Gaza!
Free, free Gaza!
We'll drown them out with love and peace. That's what we'll drown them out with, love and peace. I want to thank you all for coming out today. We're here on NAM, we're here on First Nations land. And let's again hear it loud and clear. Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land.
Be louder. Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land.
And we know that First Nations people on this continent have been fighting war and genocide and violence. And let's remember that. And let's commit today and tomorrow in our politics, in our workplaces, in our homes, to show solidarity with First Nations people and make that cry, make that statement. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Let's make it meaningful. And I want to congratulate the people of Victoria for stepping down the pathway to treaty. Well done to Victoria for taking that national step. You can show we can do this stuff. We can do this stuff. But I can't tell you how extraordinary it is to come down here. And you can be on the streets in the centre of Melbourne. You can be in my beautiful hometown of Sydney on Gadigal land. You can be walking out through the middle of Wagga. Anywhere on this country, and I'll tell you what Australians want. And I'll tell you what Australian values are that we keep having told what they are. I'll tell you what Australian values are. I'll tell you what Australians want. And it's the same thing as billions of people across this world want. We want no war and we want peace. They're the Australian values that I see. And it's now 2 weeks that this latest US forever war, this latest US forever war has been running. It's now 2 weeks that this latest US forever war, and it seems forever, because it's a continuation. It's a continuation of ongoing US and Israeli attacks and strikes. And I think to our government's eternal shame, to our government's eternal shame, the Albanese Labor government was the first government on the planet to support and endorse this latest illegal forever war. Well, shame on Labor. But I also have to tell you this, when you go into the federal parliament, and I've been there the last 2 weeks, and I've been watching Penny Wong try and justify the latest US forever war, desperately not say Donald Trump's name, desperately not say Lebanon, desperately not talk about peace. But I've been down there as one of the Greens senators in the federal parliament and our good colleague Libby in the lower house. And it is extraordinary how little there is to separate Labor, the Coalition and One Nation on this. You go down there in the federal parliament and Labor, the Coalition and One Nation, do you know what their debate last week was about the war? The debate between the Coalition and Labor and One Nation was whether or not we would congratulate the United States for beginning the illegal war, which was the Coalition's position, supported by One Nation, or whether we would support the illegal war, which was Labor's position. That was their debate. And I've seen them from the same lies that come out of Donald Trump's mouth. And they've come from Richard Marles, the Defence Minister, they've come from Albanese, the Prime Minister, they've come from Wong, the Foreign Minister. And the same lies that are being generated in Washington are being regurgitated and generated in the federal parliament from all three of the war parties. Because that's what they are. Labor, the Coalition, One Nation, they're all the same, they're all war parties. and we stand against those three war parties. And they all represent Australia. But they've been parroting the same lies that we get from Donald Trump. Apparently, our support was to stop an imminent threat of an Iranian nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, right.
Now, I thought Donald Trump told us in June that that had been obliterated. And then he told us barely a few days before this latest horrific bombing campaign that it had been obliterated. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said that it's a lie. But we get this same lie being repeated by our own government, gaslighting us, lying to us. And you know what's extraordinary? Joining in an illegal war with Israel and the US against Iran, allegedly to try and prevent a nation in the Middle East having an illegal supply of nuclear weapons contrary to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, our government is supporting Israel in that, which has hundreds of nuclear weapons in gross breach of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And you're not allowed to say that in Parliament. No one says that in Parliament. And if you mention the deep base hypocrisy there, it's like you farted in a lift in Parliament. How dare you mention this obvious hypocrisy and truth? But the Australian people aren't mugs. We know when we're being lied to. We know when they're manufacturing consent. And we know what side we want to be on in this conflict. We want to be on the side of Iranian people on the street. We want to be on the side of people in Beirut who just want to be able to go about their lives and take their kids to school. We're on the side of those mums and dads who in the first 4 hours of the US illegal attack had to remove their kids' bodies and their school bags from an appalling illegal strike on a school. We're on the sides of the mums and dads and their brothers and sisters. We're on humanity's side in this struggle. Absolutely. But I tell you, there is such a disconnect between the federal parliament and the three war parties, Labor, the Coalition and One Nation, and the mood on the ground. And there's a reason that Albanese took us into this war, sending off Australian military aircraft, sending off personnel, allowing the US to use Pine Gap and Northwest Cape, embedding Australian troops in the US military. There's a reason he decided on all of that. And they decide on AUKUS, and they decide on the supporting United States without ever asking the Australian people. Because if they know they ask the Australian people, do you want to join another US forever war? We would say in a loud, almost unified voice, no to US wars. No to war and yes to peace.
No to Israel war.
But again, I just tell you the way in which those three parties dehumanise the victims of this war is just obscene. I asked Benny Wong last week why the silence from the Albanese Labor government about the killings that are happening in Lebanon. Why the silence about the tens of thousands of Australians who are in Lebanon and no mention of it, no calling out the illegal Israeli attacks and no calling out the bombings and the more than 1 million people that are now homeless in Lebanon. And you know, in a minute and a half answer from Penny Wong in the Senate, she couldn't even bring herself to say Lebanon. She can't, because for the war parties, the people who are being attacked by US weapons, by Israeli weapons, they just don't exist. They just don't exist. If you're being attacked and bombed by Israeli missiles, by Donald Trump and US missiles, for the war parties, they just don't exist. They just wipe them away from the image. And then we get this argument that Australia should go to war in the Gulf to protect 10,000-20,000 expats in the United Arab Emirates, a country most of us have never heard about before this war started. And Labor wants us to believe that our military deployment to the United Arab Emirates came about because of a demand from the United Arab Emirates and not a demand from Donald Trump and his warmongers. We're not fools. We know what's happening. Donald Trump says jump and Anthony Albanese says how high, and it's to his eternal shame. To his absolute eternal shame. But I'll finish with this. Those same politicians who cheered on this war, from the Coalition, from One Nation, from the Labor Party, right? They're now saying to Australia, oh, we're very surprised that fuel prices are rising. And they're attacking the government or whoever they are for the rising cost of fuel and for the chaos and the economic chaos. Well, I'll tell you one way to stop the economic chaos. I'll tell you one way to unite and make this world safer and more prosperous. We reject every single illegal US war. We call out this war, we call out the next war, and we're never a part of illegal US and Israeli border wars. If you want to know what we can do now to turn Australia away from this disastrous path that the world and we are taking, we need to cut our ties with the Washington and the US military. We absolutely need to cut our ties with Washington and the US military. And we need to campaign and organise like never before to end AUKUS and stop that obscene, appalling waste of our money and commitment to US forever wars. And we will win this struggle because Donald Trump is a continuation of US policy. People think it's an aberration, but it's a continuation. And finally, the mask is being torn off of US militarism. And we're seeing it for what it is. And we're going to organize against it. We're going to organize for peace. We're going to organize for our common good. We're going to end AUKUS and make Australia a force for peace in this world. Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm Ahmed from Fidra Primary School, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
Come to the Degrowth Festival on Sunday the 22nd of March from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. Building community and resilience. Let's create the world we want by practicing it now together. Sing, dance, picnic under the trees, and check out the dozens of stalls, workshops, and talks. The 2026 Degrowth Festival, Curtin Square, Carlton. Search for Degrowth Festival 2026 on Humanitix for more details and to register. The Degrowth Festival is a 3CR supporter.
A weak solidarity Bricky team listener, when the not-so-well-off felt especially important this week as they felt in turn the warmth of the concern for them. Big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital, for instance, expressing his knowledge that yet another interest rate increase would hit them hard. See? Empathy. And more especially the Reserve Losses Bank Governor herself, Michelle Bulldust, who conceded she knew it would be tough for them, but she consoled them, it would be much worse if inflation gets built into the fibres, which might have consoled them even more if they had the slightest idea what that gobbledygook meant. What did that gobbledygook mean, we asked Jim. Absolutely no idea, but if Michelle said it, it must mean something. Perhaps if people chop a couple of $5 notes into their breakfast cereals, it may give them their daily fibre ration. And let me assure you, I know people are doing it tough. Thanks, Jim. How can those doing it tough you so care about afford two $5 notes for breakfast? A healthy breakfast will make them feel better. Maybe one $5 note. The banks also expressed their concern for those doing it tough just after they announced they would hit them with the new interest rate immediately, as of this minute. And good news for bank deposit customers. They would apply it to the pittance, or sorry, interest it pays depositors sometime this year, barring unforeseen circumstances like not applying it. It's striking the perfect balance between caring for those doing it tough and caring for ourselves, they explained. Some of those doing it tough were doing it even tougher thanks to salt, sugar and fat caring employer KFC for keep fat coming or fat profits coming or keep fast food workers conned. But sadly, Sprung, denying thousands of workers their 10-minute shift break, forced to fork out at least $29 million it ripped off those young workers. Ripped off, that's unfair. Inadvertently, of course. Obviously, a clause in the award which says workers must have a 10-minute break is very confusing and difficult to understand, as after settling the matter, Keep Fat Coming said, in agreeing to resolve the litigation, we make no admission of liability. Poor innocent KFC, but my word, $29 million is a very expensive expression of innocence. And listener, more bad news. It gets worse. Poor McDonald's Salt, Sugar and Fat faces a claim that more than 300,000 workers, true figure, were denied the break. It's still contesting the matter, arguing workers took undefined, quote, micro breaks, which add up to 10 minutes, like, say, walking from the cooking area to the counter and back to deliver and place the order. Surely that walk time shouldn't be counted as work. Should by some remote chance it lose the case, scheduled for the federal court in May, poor McDonald's will be up for hundreds of millions. What thanks for all it does for those young workers. A relatively young worker, 34-year-old Liam Harrington, working for poultry farmer Lemitech, real name, on a machine everyone knew was dangerous, killed when entangled in the roller, and what price a life. Lemitech was fined $325,000 this week. $325,000 for killing a 34-year-old worker. But the court said Lemitech showed remorse. Sure. And found the problems that killed Liam Harrington could have easily been fixed. Since the law introduced industrial manslaughter with prison time for industrial killing, strange that not one caring employer has seen the inside of a cell. They're all so remorseful. Not quite a prison cell, but stuck dependent upon those you pay to be dependent upon. Now that's unfair. We believe those ads. How could anyone doubt an ad? Aged care providers convert you into the most happy, happy, satisfied, fun upon fun person. I should have done this years ago. And to add to the exciting benefits, one large provider, O'Pauling, which runs 140 homes, decided on a two-tiered provision. Pay lots more, like $55 a day more, that's more than $20,000 a year if you last out the year, and you receive better, reasonable food, and you can keep the telly in your room, enjoy the weekly happy hour, and travel for outings, all of which used to be free. Don't pay extra, and you get the scraps, and they unscrew the telly and take it away. No happy hour or outing for you, which will teach you for being poor. But within days, as the waste matter from that food hit the fan, O'Pauling retreated slightly. The new rules would not apply to existing residents, but would apply to new ones. The $55 a day is over and above the daily fee for basic living costs and the accommodation deposit you pay just to get a room in the first place. Since the proverbial hit the fan, residents of other homes have complained of extra charges as well, including being charged extra for air conditioning. The altruistic aged care providers agreed with their ads. We should have done this years ago. Afraid we've missed the big aged care event of the week, though, of the year. Thursday and yesterday, the Melbourne Retirement Village and Resort Expo. All the fun of the aged care fair. Wonderful opportunity to ask questions and gather information, the promo told us. And here's the wow moment, the how can they afford it moment. Entry was, wait for it, free. We didn't have to pay to find out how they rip us off. Apparently the Greens have been ripping off the most vulnerable by opposing the state socialist demolishing public housing. The socialist candidate for the Greens-held seat of Richmond in the state election says she supports the demolitions and the Greens, quote, have used the state's most vulnerable residents for political gain. Shame, Greens, shame. Although, how does it benefit the state's most vulnerable residents to demolish their homes? The socialists are obviously much wiser than we are. Those who can't afford the most basic room anywhere, compassion oozing out of every pore of the Port Phillip councillors who insist on removing every poor person, kicking homeless people out of the city and confiscating their few meagre belongings. But we're not throwing them out, they said. We're just moving them on. Some difference. On to where? Like homeless people enjoy being homeless and have a choice? To make matters worse, a number of them live in a tent city near where the ASET and would-be's and caring business class establishment and lots of state socialist MPs were whooping it up on the fine food and beverages just a week or two ago at the Grand Prix. Imagine the trauma they could have suffered if forced to look upon these bludgers who pay no rent whatever to abuse public land. How selfish to submit the ASET and big business and state MPs to that danger. As the US of the UN of the US of the world and its marionette master Zion continued their slaughter of evil Iran with their clear objective like, well, take your pick, we can reflect on just how evil these regimes, other than good, good liberty, freedom and democracy love and Zion are. So aggressive, like Zion forced to attack evil Iran, Zion attacking Syria, Zion attacking evil Lebanon, Zion attacking evil Gaza, Zion attacking and occupying Jordan, Zion attacking the evil West Bank, Zion attacking evil Qatar, Zion from the river to the sea. Can we spot a pattern here of any sort? US of Big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor pleaded with several so-called allies to help in opening the Straits of Hormuz, then when they refused, said he didn't need any help anyway and attacked the True Blue Aussie for not helping, forgetting perhaps that he hadn't asked True Blue Aussie to help in the first place, or he may have assumed that as a long-term lackey or sorry ally, True Blue Aussie would just turn up as usual. Tough one. If we had been asked, do we think Big Supremo Anthony Albanese and the minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, and minister for being offensive and trained killing Colonel Richard Malls, the bad guys, he of the giant mind, would have said A, yes, or B, no? I'll give us time to think that one through, listener. And exciting news. Longtime fossil pollution executive Liz Worst Cost the Planet, who has been acting supremo of Woodside with profits since her old mate Meg O'Neill before profits took over at BP, Big Profits, Big Polluter, has been made new full-time supremo, celebrating her appointment by announcing proudly that Woodside with has slashed its local massive pollution by all of 15%. Although its Scope 3, the pollution from those to whom it flogs its fossils, isn't counted. That's their problem. And it can do this while rapidly expanding its fossil pollution all over the world. My word, Liz is a worthy replacement for Meg. And what commitment to the long, long, long transition from itself. Although Liz did announce a, quote, green ammonia project planned for the US OB to replace the highly polluting current system has been sadly cancelled due to more important matters like profit and the energy stroke water guzzling data centres. Oh, how we have to feel sorry for the aforementioned banks. The banks are complaining they are carrying the tax and other expenses can, while the giant AI good corporate citizens hive their profits offshore to themselves or to tax havens and pay stuff all tax in True Blue Aussie. App pull in the profits, for instance, the banks complained, has a capitalization 7 times the big 4 banks combined, but paid less company tax than the banks pay in a fortnight. Step one here. Don't we feel sorry for the poor banks? And step two, well, would we take seriously suggestions the great corporates dodge their taxes? Of course not. We can be sure they meet their legal tax obligations. Although Goo Your Gullible is delaying a $20 million data center investment while it sorts out a little problem like, would this mean it might have to pay tax in True Blue Aussie? Yet it gets a bit confusing. We are not asking for incentives, public funds or changes to the treatment of our businesses in True Blue Aussie, it said. So what's the problem? In response, the socialists said the data center tax worries would be worked through, which, dare we say it, might be a worry. But a bit of lateral thinking. One obvious solution would be to reduce the onerous burden on the poor banks. Finally, as Jim Chalmers' Capital wrestles with slashing spending on peripheral matters like basic services, it was revealed the public bailout of highly polluting aluminium smelter Tomago will cost $300 million a year. The caring business class isn't complaining about that spending. And as Jim suggests, maybe the big polluters should pay a little more of their super profits. The Trubler was the Energy Producers Profits Association warns this could be the end of big pollution as we know it. Destroy our pollution security, stifle more investment in transitioning from themselves. Wouldn't that be a disaster? Good morning.
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 on your dial.
In the cool of the evening, when everything is getting kind of groovy, you call me up and ask me, would I like to go with you and see a movie? At first I say no, I've got some plans for tonight, and then I stop and say alright. Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little boy like you. You always keep me guessing, I never seem to know what you are thinking. And if a girl looks at you, it's for sure your little eye be winking. I get confused, 'cause I don't know where I stand, and then you smile and hold my hand. Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little boy like you. Spooky. If you decide someday to stop this little game that you are playing, I'm gonna tell you all the things my heart's dying to be saying. Just like a ghost, you've been a-haunting my dreams, so now I know you're not what you seem. Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little boy like you. Spooky. Spooky.
You're back with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Daryl Croke on the phone. He's from the AEU, and if you have been under a rock, you won't realise that there is going to be a 24-hour teachers strike on Tuesday. G'day, Daryl. How are you?
Oh, g'day. How are you?
Good.
I just want to clarify something. It's not a teacher strike.
Oh, what is it?
Well, it's a strike of educators. Our principals will be coming out on strike, and so will education support staff.
Oh, wow. So it's actually a... All right. So that's...
So we're an industry union, so anyone who works for the Department of Education in a school is covered by the AEU.
All right. So this is a complete closing down of the public education system.
Well, I wish. We're not quite there yet. We're getting closer.
You're getting closer. And there's really important reasons for why the educators are going out on strike on Tuesday. So give our listeners some understanding of what's going on.
Well, schools are critically underfunded. We're $2.4 billion underfunded. One of the ways that's manifesting is the fact that teachers' wages and ES wages and principal wages are well behind those of other states. Some levels at least $10,000 to $15,000, depending on classifications, behind other states.
Yeah, that's pretty significant.
We need smaller class sizes to be more effective. We need less face-to-face teaching time, so we're going to have more planning time. Principals are under the burden of extreme workload, and ES, the support staff, are undervalued and don't get paid. Not even getting paid a paid lunch break while they're at work. So these are the things that are driving the dispute. We want to be respected at work, and we want to have dignity at work, and we're not treated very well by the department at the moment. And so we are taking industrial action.
Now, the thing about it is this has been boiling for quite a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. We've been banging this drum for at least 10 years since Gonski, saying we should get more money and we should be paying the people in the system a better wage.
The reasons for why you're under-resourced over a significant period of time, has the government at all given some understanding of why they believe that it's a reasonable position to be in?
Yeah, it's a strange debate where your opponent actually agrees with you but then doesn't concede. So if this is a debate, then everyone would agree that the system's underfunded, but they're not ramping up, they're not putting the money in place.
And it's kind of interesting, isn't it, because they've obviously been putting money into other things rather than taking dealing with core government business, which you'd have to say education is.
Yeah, I mean, health and education should be the first priority, looking after young people, looking after old people, looking after the community. I mean, that's what it should be about.
Now, you're going to go on strike, and I know that people are gathering on at 10:30 on Tuesday morning outside Victoria Trades Hall. Can you give our listeners some understanding about what's going on?
Okay, so I'll give you clarity. So, look, I just want to context this by we've got a big upsurge in union membership. This has been a more exciting buzz than the last time that we took a rally, and the last time we rallied we got between 10,000 and 15,000. We're gonna probably double that. There's been a big upsurge in union membership since the start of the year, 30% up. The union has to then go get more people from Trades Hall to actually sign everyone up because we're overflowed at the moment. In my region, schools are usually off the radar, are stepping up with a dramatic increase in membership. So most schools in my region will be affected in some way, from cancelling classes outright to only offering one or two year levels. Parents are getting on board as well. So what my region is doing is we're going to have our own contingent, and our contingent is going to assemble at the State Library. This is people in the Broadmeadows area, from Glenroy all the way up to Craigieburn, at the State Library at 9:50. Then we're going to march to the Trades Hall at 10:20 to look out for a Broadmeadows banner and the Red Peace banner from Glenroy. Parents are going to assemble at 10 a.m. at the corner of Rathdown Street and Victoria Parade. For those who have small children, there'll be quite a section of the rally for them. Now, the main assembly point is it going to be at Trades Hall, and that's at 10:30 a.m. And there's already been street closures, so please use public transport because that section of the city will be locked down. So that's really what the plan is, and expect a big and very loud rally.
Now, what are you hoping to achieve by doing this?
A couple of things. One is we have got people going on strike for the first time who haven't had that experience. So most importantly, I want this to be an empowering experience for them. So when they come back to their schools, they'll feel just a bit more confident, they'll feel a bit braver, and then they'll be, and hopefully sign those people up who haven't joined the union yet, and actually start to then participate in what will probably be a long campaign. The government will probably, hopefully, give some ground, but realistically, I don't think they will give enough ground. I don't think one strike's going to be enough. So, therefore, we need to build an ongoing campaign. So this is a building block for the next step. So if we get 30,000 this time, my expectation would be we're in a position to actually have a bigger rally next time. If we got 70% coverage, I want that to be 80, 85% coverage. So I want this to be a building block.
Okay, and the next thing, of course, is that it's an election year, and actually you don't care which government's in power, you want
them...
Well,
no, I do. I mean, of course I do. I don't want the Liberal Party in power. So what I think is the main power is the working class. I want to get this resolved before the election. That's where I think power lies. It's in the streets, it's in the workplace. Now,
okay.
You know, I don't want this to be an election issue, because who are we going to vote for, the Liberal Party? No, not on. So look, we want to have this settled out and won, Now, then if the Labor Party doesn't come around, there's other progressive parties on the left that we could potentially vote for. Now, that's coming from me, Darrell Craig. That's not the union position. I'm not sure what they're going to say, but I also think the rank and file, given that we've got a government in power that's not listening to us, then they could make their own decisions later on.
And you want supporters to come and support you on Tuesday?
Yes, I do. So, if, and then here's an argument about centrality of the working class or the socialists out there and anarchists out there. This is it. You're up. Yeah, we want you to be marching with us. So you can choose where you want to march. I've told you the details. So it's if you come from vaguely in the north area, come and march with us. That's at 9:50 onwards. If you're living in another area, go to Trades Hall at 9:30. Sorry, 10:30. And if you've got little kids, start off at the corner of RAF down at Victoria Parade.
Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, okay. Darrell.
No worries. Bye bye.
Yeah, and that was Darrell Croak from the AEU. He's a regional rep, and as he said, everyone's meeting for the rally on Tuesday in the city. We're going to play a little bit of the report that we've got for you on public housing. There was the government has moved on the Holland Court Tower, starting to remove asbestos, despite people still being in situ. This is some of the report of the rally that was held on Friday. And there's also a little bit of a sound from a picnic at Harriet's place on Spring Street, trying to persuade her that she's taking a wrong turn.
Basically, Homes Victoria is trying to demolish the towers and they're trying to kick the last of the residents out. They're making them as uncomfortable as possible. They're doing drilling while residents are still inside. We're almost certain they're removing asbestos while residents are still inside. They're putting up all this security fencing that intimidates people so that they don't feel safe there. They're trying to offer the remaining residents deals where they will be basically placed into social housing where they have less rights. But these residents, they feel like they're between a rock and a hard place, so they have to choose that. And basically, once all the residents are out, they plan to knock all the towers down and then sell the land to private developers, and none of it is going to be replaced with public housing at all. It's going to be replaced with private rentals and social housing, and social housing people don't have as many rights. We're basically trying to stop that from happening. We're trying to organize, you know, whatever we can. We're going through bureaucratic methods, we're going through some more spicy methods. We're doing everything we can to try and save these towers, because if these towers go, that's so many homes that are for vulnerable, marginalized people that will be lost. More people will be on the streets, more people will be pushed into private rental markets, which is just going to up the rental prices in all of the inner and outer city. It's believed a lot of the residents have moved from Flemington. They're basically being pushed out to places like Craigieburn, so they're going to be isolated from their communities and cut off from services as well. So it's really important that we stop the demolition of the 44 public housing towers and save public housing.
And near the corner of Holland Court, we're just outside one of the first towers to be... There's still people in there, but housing's been doing their very best to empty it. And apparently just in the last couple of weeks, they've started demolition work, which they said, anyway, they seem to have given assurances that they won't. But there's signs up saying demolition, which apparently they've now covered those signs, but they're starting to rip asbestos out even when there's people inside. The bigger issue here, other people could talk more about this particular location, but... I'm a member of Vic Socialists. I believe that houses should be there to house people rather than just for some, speculator or whatever. And public housing, public housing is perfect. It's just appalling that the Labor government wants to demolish public housing, basically privatise it, bring all the 44 towers, demolish all of the 44 towers, and then have some sort of community or social housing or whatnot, which is basically a privatisation. And there should be a hell of a lot more public housing, really. It's security for people, lowers the cost of housing generally. The only thing wrong with it is that there's this whole army of parasites, basically, that get rich off real estate, and public housing doesn't suit them. And it also keeps working class people secure. I don't know what the... Well, I do know what the government's got against that. That they want us all mean and lean and hungry, and they want a dog-eat-dog society. So this little protest here today... It's standing up for the people in this tower, standing up for the people in this estate, and standing up for public housing. So should be more of it. Pretty heartening, actually. Like, you know, people would have heard just before, you know, a whole series of people driving past, and, you know, public housing has had a... the powers that be have given it a really bad press over a lot of years, but there's a lot of support for public housing just for ordinary people who knows, you know, what it's all about.
Hi, my name's Catherine Murdoch. I'm with Victorian Socialists and I live at Kensington in Clifford Terrace. I'm a member of our public housing community. And yesterday we have a community lunch once a week that's healthy living and learning. And we had the co-health relocation team on site to discuss with residents from Ormond Street the relocation. And they were very inhumane in their approach in terms of minimalising how traumatic and how harming this relocation is. It's an over 55 building, so a lot of the residents have complex health issues. English is a second language, and they're a very, very close community, connected in with people in the other buildings as well. So they used words like we know it's a difficult time and it can cause some worry. So we'll be here once a week to talk to you and to assist you. However, it was like they were reading from a script and it was really dehumanising the situation. Not even touching on the significant trauma. We've had 5 residents die in that building this year, and the most recent resident was called Rod, and he was openly opposed to the relocation, very outspoken at meetings to the Department of Housing about the Unison arm selling off that property to profit and profiting from the development, and he wanted to fight it. And we attended his funeral a week ago. He actually died of a heart attack in his bed. So just from a resident's perspective, it's a really, really challenging time, and some people are really suffering. We're doing all we can through 44 flats, and I live on site, and through the neighbourhood house, and actually the Unison team at Kensington are very supportive one-on-one of residents as well. But CoHealth were the people who got me into public housing. They were the people who got my back when I experienced domestic violence twice. They were my lifeline, and that's why I'm able to be here today. And so it was just horrific for me to see the corporatisation, the sellout. It was like they were reading from a script and they were not approachable. That's it. They've sold out. They've lost the plot. They can call themselves social workers or occupational therapists, but their heart's not in it. And they weren't human.
What I want to do is I just want to acknowledge how many deaths have occurred while this privatisation sellout of public housing has been happening. We know that it impacts on people's health, their well-being, their quality of life, and communities. It destroys communities. So in Ormond Street at Kensington, we've had 5 people die this year in the building. So I just want to acknowledge all the people that have died homeless on the streets of Melbourne, all the people on the list waiting, while it's being destroyed, losing hope, I want to acknowledge the people who are suffering in towers at the moment with housing uncertainty, watching their communities be shredded. And I also just want to acknowledge everyone here today, the strength of community and spirit and everyone coming together. Because without that, we're dead in the water. And the public housing's gone. We've been asking for public housing to be built for 40 years. Not for the poor people, but just for the people, for the workers. So someone who's working, someone who's elderly, someone who's got chronic health problems, someone who's fled a war-torn country can have a home. It's a human right. And the Australian government, from the PM all the way down, are massacring us. When public housing is under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When public housing is under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When our communities are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Housing is a human right. We're going to fight, fight, fight.
Housing is a human right. We're going to fight, fight, fight. Human right. We're going to fight, fight, fight.
Public housing here to stay. Greedy developers, go away.
Public housing here to stay. Greedy developers, go away.
Public housing here to stay.
Greedy developers, go away.
Sell out Xing in the bin. Who's in the bin? Sell out Xing.
Sell out Xing in the bin. Who's in the bin? Sell out Xing.
You're asking why I'm here today. We're here as a we're peacefully having a picnic. We're having a picnic slash picket. We're picnicking picketers. It's a whole new form of activism which I've just invented, which has been done as a protest against Harriet Shings, our Labor's Minister for Housing's decision not to release any of the 146 building reports which justify the demolition of the 44 public housing towers, which will leave 10,000 of society's most vulnerable people in housing insecurity during a housing crisis. So we're just asking, should we've invited her to the picnic? So I'm sure she will come down and join us, and she'll have a document. So we'll probably see her anytime soon, lovely Harriet. We shall make sure we leave her some grapes and some barbecue shapes. Don't eat all the barbecue shapes, leave some for Harriet in case she comes down. It'd be very embarrassing if she came down and there was no shapes and there was no barbecue shapes.
Long as I got my plastic cheese, I'm sitting on the dashboard of my car. Going 90, it ain't scary, cause I got the Virgin Mary sitting on the dashboard of my car. I'm in the backseat sinning, Jesus up there grinning, sitting on the dashboard of my car. My fella sitting on the dashboard of my car. As long as I got my plastic Jesus sitting on the dashboard of my car.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.